The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
The last few days, I've been thinking about the topic of karma. It's a very important topic in Buddhism. And in fact, one of the important perspectives that a practitioner of Buddhism is supposed to bring along as they practice is a perspective, sometimes it's described as faith in karma or belief in karma. And so some people, because of the metaphysical associations with karma, are a little bit troubled by that kind of idea, because the way the word karma has entered into English language, it's come to English through all kinds of ways. And so come from yoga, from Hinduism, from Buddhism, from different schools of Buddhism. And there's many different belief systems connected to karma. And some of them have to do with people will sometimes use the word karma to mean the results of your past actions. Well, that's your karma, that you got a flat tire or something. And so, so the karma is the result of something you did in the past. And so so it's important to be very careful when you hear the word karma in Buddhist context to be interested in what does karma mean in the context of the teachings of the Buddha, for example. And so I've been thinking about this some today, and I'm not going to do a full discussion about that today, but I want to talk about how the Buddha approached the topic of karma in one particular discourse, Discourse 98 in the middle-length discourses. And so one of the things you should know is the word karma literally means action. And we might stretch that a little bit into English and say it means activity. But it's a particular kind of action or activity the person does. And so it doesn't automatically imply the results of your actions. That's another word for that. It's usually translated into English as fruit. There's the action and there's the fruit of the action, the consequence. But karma literally means action. And this discourse has an interesting verse, a very nice verse, I think, at the end. And it's maybe it's still popular enough. I learned this English expression when I was a child, and I don't think I've heard it much since then, except it goes through my head occasionally. You've probably heard it, you know, that love makes the world go round. Do people still say that? Or was that only when I was a kid that worked? So here, this is a verse attributed to the Buddha. Action makes the world go round. Action makes this generation of people turn. Living beings are tied up in their action, like the chariot wheel by the linchpin. So action makes the world go round. So the word here is karma. Karma makes the world go around. Action. So here, the stress is that tremendous importance action has at the, you know, it's called the linchpin of the wheel. So it's like at the heart of what this world that spins around, the social world, the human world especially, somehow it spins around based on action. And in some ways, that's a little bit more satisfying than the word love. Love is great. I wish it was true that it made the world go around. But there are unfortunately many other things that gets people spinning around and turned upside down and besides love, and so action kind of speaks to a broader range of how this world works. So it doesn't say much if, say, action turns the world, turns the social world, the human world around. But then you have to say, why the emphasis on action? Why is that important for the Buddhists? So in this particular discourse, it has to do with two Brahmanical students, Brahmin students, who come to ask the question about a dispute they have with each other. So these two these are very well-learned Brahmins. Brahmins are the priestly class in India. They still, to this day, they have this class of people, kind of like a caste. And in ancient India, at the time of the Buddha, they had the Brahmins, and they were kind of like the priest class. And they considered themselves superior to everyone else. Whereas everyone else was born from other parts of the great god Brahma, the creator god, kind of the the Brahmins are born from his mouth. You know, and so like the untouchables, the kind of lowest class, are born from his feet, which is pretty dirty. They walk around barefoot. So they consider themselves very, very lofty. And probably, I think most historians think that the Brahmins were descended from the Eurasian invaders who came down from the steppes of Russia and places and came and invaded into northern India, I don't know, 4,000 or 5,000 years ago, and kind of conquered much of India and established themselves as kind of the ruling class. And so supposedly they were more light-skinned as opposed to the native Indians who were darker-skinned. So there was kind of a racial kind of distinction between the Brahmins and others. And the Brahmins believed that their positions as the priest class was hereditary. That they were passed down through their family lineage, and that's how you're a Brahmin. You couldn't be a Brahmin unless you had that blood, if you were kind of continued that way. So, so they're an important class of people in India. And so there were these two students who were these Brahminical priests. They were very well trained in the lore, the teachings of the Vedas, of the Brahmins. And they had a dispute. And their dispute was how is a person a Brahmin? What makes a person a Brahmin? And one person, one of these students, says, when one is well born on both sides, a pure maternal and paternal descent seven generations back, unassailable and impeccable in respect of birth, then one is a Brahmin. So that's pretty sure. You have to know your genealogy and prove it so you can have your card-carrying Brahmin card. And the other student said, had a different opinion, and his opinion was, when one is virtuous and fulfills the observances, then one is a Brahmin. So you're not a Brahmin by birth, but by being virtuous. And then the observances probably means that there were Brahmanical rituals and rites that had to be performed. So if you were trained and could do those properly, then you are a Brahmin. So one said it's by birth, another says it's by action. So then they went to the Buddha to resolve their dispute. What did he think? And so they come and they explain to him, we possess the knowledge of the triple Vedas, our sacred texts. We are the students of very famous Brahmanical teachers. We've attained full mastery over all the Vedic experts, over all that Vedic experts teach. We are skilled in philology and grammar. We match our teachers in recitation. A dispute has arisen between us concerning the question of birth and class. One of us says one is a Brahmin by birth, the other by action. Since we can't convince each other, we've come to talk to you and ask you, what do you think? And the Buddha... So one of the interesting things is that the question is literally, is it by action or by... And action means like virtue and observances, or is it by birth? And the Buddha kind of agrees with one of them. Probably imagine which one he agrees with. But he does a kind of, he's going to do kind of sleight of hand, which is very interesting here. As he, well, I think it's sleight of hand. So he starts off by saying, I will teach you in the order as they really are. So the order of the really are, I think, implies, you know, since the Brahmins lived in, saw the world through order of castes. There was a highest order and a lowest order. He's going to start off with that. I will teach you in the order as they really are. The generic divisions of living beings, for many are the kinds of birth. Know first the grass and trees. Though they lack self-awareness, the birth is their distinctive mark, for many are the kinds of birth. In other words, how you're born as a plant tells what you're going to be. If you're an oak seedling, you become an oak tree. If you're a redwood, you become a redwood tree. And so you can distinguish them by the marks, what they look like. Next comes the moths and butterflies, and so on through to ants and termites. Their birth is their distinctive mark, for many are the kinds of birth. Then know the kinds of quadrupeds, of varied sorts, both small and large. Their birth is their distinctive mark, for many are the kinds of birth. So there's lots of four-legged animals, and so you can distinguish them by, you know, by how they look, by how they're, you know, the distinctive marks mean how they look, their shape, their color, their, you know, something. You see the differences between a dog and a mountain lion, for example. Know those whose bellies are their feet. Isn't that? I think it means snakes. Their birth is their distinctive mark. For many are the kinds of birth, many kinds, born many different kind of shapes and species. Know, too, the water-dwelling fish, their pasture in the liquid world. Their birth is their distinctive mark, for many are the kinds of birth. Next, know the birds that wing their way as they range in upon skies. Their birth is their distinctive mark. While in these births, the differences of birth make their distinctive mark, with humans, no difference of birth make a distinctive mark in them. That's quite a powerful statement, probably in his time, that there's no distinct difference to be, no distinctive mark, really represents a species difference, you know, or a generic difference, any important difference from what the Buddha says. Nor in the hairs, nor in the head, nor in the ears, nor in the eyes, nor in the mouth, nor in the nose, nor in the lips, nor in the brows, nor in the shoulders or the neck, nor in the belly or the back, nor in the buttocks or the breast, nor in the genitals or ways of mating, nor in the hands, nor in the feet, nor in the fingers or the nails, nor in the knees, nor the thighs, nor in the color or in voice. Here birth makes no distinctive mark, as with the other kinds of birth. In human bodies in themselves, nothing distinctive can be found. Distinction among human beings is purely a verbal designation. So of course we see differences, right, between people. But in order to characterize people differently, like a different species or some radically different, there's nothing in physical characteristic that warrants a difference. The differences that we make for each other have to do with verbal designation, says the Buddha. That's a very powerful statement in some circles. It pulls the rug from some people's worldview. So I'm going to read it as it says. I often try to change the gender so that it's gender neutral, because these are often said in male pronoun stuff, but sometimes it's kind of hard. This is kind of poetry. You'll hopefully forgive me. Who makes his living among men by varied crafts, you should know, is called a craftsman. He is not a Brahmin. Who makes his living among men by merchandise, you should know, is called a merchant. He is not a Brahmin. Who makes his living among men by serving others, you should know, is called a servant. He is not a Brahmin. Who makes his living among men by stealing is called a robber. He is not a Brahmin. Who makes his living among men by archery is called a soldier. He is not a Brahmin. Who makes his living among men by priestly craft is called a chaplain. He is not a Brahmin. Who governs among men, the town and realm, is called a ruler. He is not a Brahmin. So then he's going to say, now he's going to say, who is a Brahmin? Oh, no, not quite yet, but I call him not a Brahmin because of his origin or lineage. If impediments still lurk in him, he is just one who says, sir, meaning a little bit kind of a highfalutin language is what it means, who speaks with highfalutin language, one who is unimpeded and clings no more. He is the one I call a Brahmin. The person who is unimpeded and clings no more, so especially clings no more, we can understand. So Buddha here defines someone who's a Brahmin by the fact that they don't cling. So this is the kind of speaking the sleight of hand. He's saying by your actions are you defined, and the actions are external, the way you, the livelihood in which you live the world in. And then he kind of turns it and says something about the inner psychology of the person is what defines a Brahmin. It's not by physical characteristics. It's not even by what profession you do, but rather how your mind is or your heart is. And the first thing he says is think about being without clinging. The one who has cut off all fetters, who is no more by anguish shaken, who has overcome all attachments, he is the one I call a Brahman, who has cut each strap and thong, the reins and bridle band as well, whose crossbar is lifted, the awakened one, he is the one I call a Brahman, who endures without a trace of hate, abuse, violence, and bondage too, with strength of patience well arrayed, is the one I call a Brahman, who does not flare up with anger, dutiful, virtuous, and humble, subdued, bearing the final body, he is the one I call a Brahman, who, like the rain on lotus leaves, or mustard seed on the point of an owl, meaning they just washes right off, clings not at all to sensual pleasures, is the one I call a Brahman, who knows right here within oneself the destruction of all suffering, with burden lowered and detached, is the one I call a Brahman, who with deep understanding wise can tell the path from the non-path and has attained the goal supreme, I call a Brahman, who has laid aside weapons against all beings frail and bold, who does not kill or have them killed, I call a Brahman, who is unopposed among the opponents, peaceful among those given to violence, who does not cling among those who cling, I call a Brahman, who has dropped all lust and hate, dropped conceit and contempt, like a mustard seed on the point of an owl, I call a Brahman, who utters speech free from harshness, full of meaning, ever truthful, which does not offend anyone, I call a Brahman, who in the world will never take what is not given, long or short, small or big or fair or foul, I call a Brahman, who has no inner yearnings regarding this world or the next, who lives unyearning and detached, I call a Brahman, who has no more indulgences, no more perplexity, since he knows, who has gained firm footing in the deathless, I call a Brahman, who has transcended all ties here of both merit and evil deeds, is sorrowless, stainless, and pure, I call a Brahman, who pure as the spotless moon is clear and limpid, and in whom delight and being have been destroyed, I call a Brahman, who has passed beyond the swamp, the mire, samsara, all delusion, who has crossed to the further shore and meditates within the jhanas, is unperturbed and unperplexed, attain nibbana through non-clinging, I call a Brahman, who has abandoned craving too and wanders here in homelessness, with craving destroyed, I call a Brahman, whose destination is unknown to gods, to spirits, and to men, an arhat with taints destroyed, I call a Brahman, who know, okay, for name and clan are assigned as mere designations in the world. Originating in conventions, they are assigned here and there. For those who do not know this fact, wrong views have long underlain their hearts. Not knowing, they declare to us, one is a Brahmin by birth. One is not a Brahmin by birth, nor by birth a non-Brahmin. By action is one a Brahmin. By action is one a non-Brahmin. So this is probably a little bit upsetting to some people to hear this, the Brahmins in particular. You know, what? I was born this way for seven generations. I know who I am. So what the Buddha is doing here, he's another sleight of hand, is he's saying, he's taking a common word accepting the use of it, using it, but redefining it, kind of reappropriating it for his own purpose, and so kind of pulling the rug underneath the original. This is a common trick of the Buddha, was rather than opposing what people did, he would often take their concepts and say, great, now let me tell you what it really means. So by action is one of Brahman. So in the action, the Buddha keeps, you know, you saw that long list. The action that he's focusing on is pretty much all psychological. It has all to do with, you know, state of your mind, free of craving, free of hate, free of lust, free of confusion. That somehow, when you do the inner work of changing yourself, of waking up, that's what qualifies you as a Brahman. So that is how the truly wise see action as it really is. Seers of dependent origination, skilled in action and its results. So skilled in action and its results. So this is also a very important term. So it isn't just a matter of recognizing that action, especially the psychological action, activity of what we do inside, is what counts. But that what the Buddha was teaching was a training program for how to take more, to become skilled, to become trained in action, in the psychological action. So we don't just go along and just continue with our minds and hearts as they were received, for as we happen to find them the day we wake up to it, but we can then begin to train ourselves and change the quality, the characteristics, the action, the activity of our mind and hearts. So it becomes, in this language of this text here, so it becomes pure, clean, like clean and bright like the full moon. Action makes the world go round. Action makes this generation turn. Living beings are bound by action, like the chariot wheel by the linchpin. Spiritual practice, self-control, and inner training. By this one becomes a Brahman. In this supreme Brahmanhood lies. So action then becomes very important. And so part of the reason why action is important is you become the kind of you become a Brahmin. But I don't think the Buddha was that interested in creating a class of people who walk around calling themselves Brahmins. He was just talking to these Brahmins in order to kind of, you know, turn the table on them, I guess. But he was interested in helping people suffer less and become people who not only suffer less themselves, but don't cause suffering on others. And this kind of person is considered a noble person, a dignified person, a wise person in the Buddhist tradition. It's held up in high esteem that a person who has managed to overcome their own suffering and overcome the tendency to cause suffering to others, there's such people are held up in high esteem and respected a lot. One of the interesting aspects of becoming such a person of high esteem, Buddhism holds these people in high esteem, is that if you hold yourself in high esteem, you're probably still suffering. So, you know, it doesn't do you much psychological good to be esteemed by others when you don't care anymore. So because, you know, that's the whole idea, is to be free of that kind of caring, that kind of being tied up in self-identity issues like that. But still, the tradition holds these people up in high esteem. And but the way to that, the path, so the Buddha then offers a path. And it's probably appropriate to call it a path of action. So karma is important. What you do is important. So the action is a training program. And that training program involves two kinds of action. It involves what you do and what you don't do. And sometimes the emphasis is on not doing certain things, restraining oneself or avoiding certain behavior. And sometimes the emphasis is on action, what you do and what you cultivate. Sometimes the non-doing has a lot to do with learning how to let go. And that's the non-action part. And the action part has a lot to do with what you cultivate and what you develop, how you train yourself. And those two go hand in hand. Both are important. If you emphasize one over the other, it becomes lopsided. Some people only emphasize too much the cultivation part, the action part, and it becomes a lot of work to do spiritual practice, and they're kind of like tying themselves up, and it becomes a big engineering project to train themselves. And some people emphasize letting go at the exclusion of cultivation, and it can be nice to let go, but you can't really let go fully and deeply unless you develop some inner strength. Where some of your different mental faculties become strong and well-developed. So I don't know if this is a fair comparison, but I think that there was a time, kind of a time in American culture, where maybe 100 years ago or something, that it's considered valuable for people to toughen themselves up, to steel themselves up. And you had to kind of, that was kind of the character building, and that you managed to get through the world okay. And then by the time I was being raised, it seemed like it was like this pendulum had swung. And that was considered to be kind of abhorrent, this idea that you would steel yourself and toughen yourself up. And the idea was to be kind of just relaxed and easygoing and soft and accepting and, you know, kind of like just, you know. And so not making any effort was kind of like valued a lot. And now people have discovered that you need some combination of both. And it's something as so simple as, for example, if some people who have back problems, resting is not the best thing to do. And you think it's supposed to let go and rest and recover. Sometimes what you need to do is build up your strength. And when the muscles get stronger, they hold the back better, and so it works. So sometimes we need to rest, sometimes we need to build up strength. And when we build up the strength for the back, then I think it's easier to let go and relax in a deeper way, because if we let go when we're not strong, we might injure ourselves further. So the same way psychologically, spiritually, that we need is a combination of both. The beginning of the path for Buddha, often when he began it, involved particular activities, and not necessarily just psychological activities, but kind of activities that we do and don't do, that I believe, are relatively easy for people to do compared to cultivating stronger meditation practice, mindfulness or concentration, where you're tracking your mind. Sometimes tracking what you do with your body is easier than tracking what goes on in that very fast mind that spins around out of control. And so the beginning of the training is to begin to practice generosity. Generosity is an activity you can do. You can plan ahead. You can plan like a month ahead and build yourself and get yourself ready to do an act of generosity. So you don't have to kind of like have the fortitude to do it in the moment. If you think it's a good idea to practice generosity, you can, you know, anybody can cultivate and develop it if they, you know, it doesn't require, you know, wealth. It doesn't require a lot of things. But it's an action that you can do. It doesn't even require wanting to do it. but it's something you can do. And so the fact that, so it begins with what you can do. And something begins to shift and change for many people when their training is focused on what you can do as opposed to trying to change your inner life first and foremost. You change your inner life by your doing. I think so tonight we have the recovery program here. There's a great saying in AA, which is, bring your body and your mind will follow. I think it's a really wise expression. So by focusing on what you can do, something begins shifting inside. And then the idea is, as you do these things, you can also develop some confidence in yourself. It shifts your kind of relationship to yourself. Because if you're only trying to kind of internally shift your depression or shift your anger or shift your fear, it can be very hard to get a handle on it. And if that's how you measure your well-being, by those things, you kind of sunk, maybe. But if you're measuring yourself a little bit by your actions of what you do, you can start feeling a little bit better about yourself. Oh, at least I did some generosity. I did some good things for my community. So often that's where the Buddha emphasizes the beginning of the path. So that's a doing, an action. The next step is non-action, which is his way, first way in which he talked about ethics. Cultivating moral integrity was mostly defined by what you don't do. You don't kill, you don't lie, you don't steal, you don't engage in sexual misconduct, and you don't intoxicate yourself. So it might be hard to avoid doing those things for some people, but they're kind of gross activities. You know, it's like, again, it's not, you know, stealing. Stealing is something physical usually that we do. And it's easier to monitor your body, what you do sometimes, than it is to monitor your what goes on in your mind. You might want to steal, and maybe you can't control necessarily what your desires are, but at least try to control what you do with your hands. And so these are grosser activities than the subtlety of the mind. And so the day is to begin training yourselves there. And there are some people for whom it builds a lot of confidence, a lot of self-esteem, a lot of strength, and a lot of mindfulness to practice the practice of restraint. And sometimes that's all people can do, is to restrain themselves. So for people who don't need to restrain themselves, maybe it's not a good teaching for them. So well, some of you don't need it, right? You're already well-mannered. And but it's worth considering that these are the starting point for Buddhist practice. Then from there, from here, that is a foundation. Then the balance of going back and forth between action and non-action, letting go and cultivation, plays itself out in increasingly subtle ways until eventually it comes into the subtlety of how your mental activity as well, mental action. And then there are times where it's useful just let go and not do anything there. The mind starts thinking and you let go. And sometimes it's helpful to cultivate certain qualities. Like you, this is a time where I'm going to cultivate more loving kindness. And so we cultivate that a little bit. And then you come to a point where even cultivating loving kindness is too much. Cultivating concentration is too much. And oddly enough, amazingly enough, there comes a time when meditation is quite strong, mindfulness is quite strong, where even cultivating mindfulness is too much. And so you have to let go of even mindfulness in order to continue the path. So this ability to let go and to cultivate. And the goal for all doing all this is to become a person who's, if you'd like to be this kind of person, to be a Brahmin. And so some of you are already well on your way to being Brahmins, I'm sure. I'm confident. And I hope that that path is one that serves you and serves the world around you. That's one that helps you to suffer less, to be less caught up in your cravings and your reactivity in the world, and lets you be freer, and that it serves the world by you being someone who does two things, doesn't harm other people, and supports other people so they can become freer as well, so others can become Brahmins. So action. The world turns on action, but how it turns depends on what action you do. So choose your action carefully. Is that a good? We have 5 minutes. Is that enough? Or would you like to ask questions or protest? Or yes, please, Danny, right? I'll try to repeat the question, so. So you've heard karma being translated as conditioned action or habitual actions or the cause of what was that last one?
Causes and conditions.
So there's something to that in that the tradition distinguishes between two kinds of actions. There's one kind of action that's created by intention. And in fact, the connection between two is so close that the Buddha defined karma by intention. The quality of your inner intention is what characterizes the quality of the activity and affects the consequences, that's the psychological consequences, the karmic consequences that are going to be resulting. So if intentions are habitual or intentions are part of the conditioning, then yes, karma is conditioned action or habitual action. The word karma is always a kind of activity that does lead to consequences. That's, you know, the it sets something in momentum in motion that's going to come back somehow or other and affect you. Sometimes immediately in the present, sometimes in a few minutes, sometimes a few days, sometimes later. There's another activity, and that is that for people who have who are free, who have experienced enlightenment, the tradition says their activity has no karma. So it still has consequences in the world, you know, it still has consequences in the world. But the consequences no longer create any, there's no longer any psychological consequences for them. So an enlightened person might be generous and give something to someone, but it's a little bit more spontaneous than intentional. And it doesn't create the conditions, it doesn't condition or shape that person's mind anymore. The mind is kind of like, once the mind is pure or empty, or I don't know what the best word is here, once the mirror has been cleaned totally, then there's nothing, no matter what activity happens, it doesn't stain the cloth or doesn't fill the bowl or doesn't, you know, doesn't affect the mirror anymore. So once you're enlightened, you can do these things, but there's no attachment, there's no momentum, there's no ripples that get created. So each thing that gets done and it's kind of karmically finished. So those are the two different kinds of karma or activities. Karmic activities, which have momentum and ripples, and non-karmic activities, which are the activities of an enlightened person. Does that make some sense? If an enlightened person is generous to you, there might be consequences. You might feel happy, but those wouldn't be karmic consequences, because karmic consequences are only those that affect us in our well-being into the future. So, if I'm generous to you, I might go home and I'm, you know, having tea in the afternoon, remember that, and feel, oh, that was really nice. That was a good thing, and feel kind of inspired. Wow. I'm able to be generous. That's nice. So it's kind of, you know, and I feel good about myself, and then I'm more likely to do it in the future. So that would be kind of like the karmic consequences for me. The consequences for you, I don't know what the consequences are going to be for you. I could give you a ticket for the playoff games tonight. And I feel good. I gave generous to you. I did nice things for you, and you're kind of jazzed initially, but you go to the game, but they lose horribly. Not only that, but the baseball hits you in the nose, and you go home with a lost game and a bloody nose, and you're just like, I wish that Gil hadn't given me that ticket. That just ruined my day. And so I don't know what the consequences are going to be for you. But I can still feel good about, you know, I feel sorry for you, but I feel sorry for you. I feel sorry for you, but the karmic consequences for me, the good karmic consequences of my generosity persists for me. And the fact that later I feel sorry for you and have compassion for you, that just improves my karma even more. So there is a kind of tendency sometimes to get into this whole karmic equation kind of thing, you know, and I don't think that's useful at all. I think what's useful is to not to measure and calculate, you know, what the karmic consequences are, but to appreciate the tremendous importance that the intention, the quality of our action, how they arises out of our intention, has important consequences. And if you want to follow a spiritual path of Buddhism, you need to take some care for what intentions, what motivates you, what attitudes you walk around in, and how they affect your actions. And without that care about your attitudes, your intentions, your motivations, it's very hard to walk the path. Okay, thank you. Brahmins.